This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Andrew Saras, has been writing about movies for 35 years. For almost 30 years, he wrote for The Village Voice. Some people regard him as the dean of American film critics. In 1962, Saras became the first American film critic to write about the auteur theory. The idea was that the director of a movie was the person most responsible for it, and that movies could be better understood if they were seen in the context of a director's complete body of work. Pauline Kael wrote a spirited critique of Saras in 1963, and as another film critic observed, Kael and Saras's wrangle over the auteur theory had the excitement of politics and sport. The intensity of their debate lured people to see new films and to see old movies in a new way. Saras is now the film critic for the New York Observer and a professor of film at Columbia University. Andrew Saras first began writing about movies in the mid-50s, when there was less film criticism than there is today.
There weren't as many varieties of it, and it was rather conventional, and it was rather official. That is to say, you know, there were serious movies and there were not so serious movies, and the prevailing attitude of serious people was that movies were, particularly Hollywood movies, were not very important or not worth spending too much time about. They were a little silly. They weren't as profound as the theater or literature. And there were very few people who, made film a kind of religion, you know, taking it very seriously. That is compared to today, where film is taken very seriously, perhaps more seriously than almost anything else.
What made you start to take film very seriously?
Well, I always loved film. I had a, guilty, intellectual attitude toward it. I loved it, but I was a little ashamed of it. And then I stopped being ashamed of it, and I realized that many of the things I liked were really very profound. And I think the year in Paris I spent in 61 sort of changed my life in that respect. I began to read very brilliant people who were writing about film, and I thought, if these people took film seriously, then that's the least I could do. And also, I began to take American films more seriously because I began to understand genres and subtexts and myths and legends whereas previously the dominant strain of film criticism was sociological, and is it important and how does it contribute to the class struggle or the struggle of the poor against the rich and so forth. It was very political and dealt with problems, so to speak, and these were the kinds of subjects that the new critics in Europe, in various cities, various places, it's all around the world. This was after the war, right after the war, in the 40s, the world was a very serious place. We had to defeat fascism and so on. But after the war, suddenly a new generation of people came up who were not so caught up in all the battles of the 30s and the 40s. And these people began to develop new attitudes toward film. And I got caught up in that, and film became very important in my life.
Do you think that you took your cues in a way from the French critics?
Well, in the beginning, they were much more serious about film than we were, and they dealt with ideas, and I like to deal with ideas. The ideas that films generate are what is important to me. And the French, they're ideological to a fault. They find ideas out of everything. There's also something else that I liked about the French, French culture as opposed to, let's say, Germanic culture. And that is, it doesn't make these false distinctions. The kitsch, is a German word. It isn't a French word. The French, and it's also something tied up with Christianity, too, with a religious attitude, that no sparrow falls that isn't noticed, and no subject is unimportant. That is to say that there are no such thing as intellectuals, subjects, and non-intellectual subjects. There are intellectuals and there are non-intellectuals. And for an intellectual, every subject is worthy of thought and discussion.
You wrote a now famous article in 1962 about the auteur theory of film. And you became the leading American exponent of the auteur theory. Explain what you meant back in 1962.
Well, many people have complained, with some justification, that it wasn't a theory at all. It was something called the politique des auteurs, which Truffaut had coined in 1954 in the Cahiers du Cinéma, and it was more a policy. It was that certain directors, you studied their works as a body, you know, and the ones that interested you, their work was always more interesting than the work of people. And this is true of all the other arts, but nobody had ever applied it quite so rigorously to film. Some people say, you know, I claim that I invented the idea of the director as a dominant artist in film, and that's not true, because film history, if you go way back to people like Graham Greene and Dwight MacDonald and John Grierson in the 30s, they always organized their studies of film. They always discussed it in terms of individual directors. So there was nothing new about that. What was new was that I took a great many American action directors, genre directors, much more seriously than they had been taken in the past. And that was the big debate I had with Pauline Kael over that at that time. Since then, of course, everything has sort of gone topsy-turvy. I mean, she's now more addicted to that even than I am. But at that time, that was it. And to me, I thought, you know, there was a lovely film directed by Max O'Fools called One Woman's Story. And when Bosley Crowther reviewed it, he didn't even mention the director's name in the review. And that would be unthinkable today, that you wouldn't mention the name of the director of anything. But my idea is this, that the act of directing a movie is different than, say, the act of directing a play, because I believe in a dramatist's theater. I'm not very enchanted with the new director's kind of theater, although I think some directors have been very creative. But basically, I believe that plays exist, are basically the dominant artist in the theater is the dramatist, person who writes the text. In the movies, however, it is not so much the script, it's what happens on the set. The film is something different than the script from which it's written.
When you started to think about movies in terms of the auteur and in terms of the director as the auteur, what kind of different reading did you come up with than mainstream film criticism had? For instance, what were some of the recognized masterpieces of the theory of the cinema at the time that you didn't think were that good, and what were some of your alternative choices?
Well, in 1960, for example, I thought one of the great films of the year was Psycho, the Alfred Hitchcock movie, and very few critics would, you know, list that as one of the best movies of the year, although that many of them liked it, but they didn't think it would be important enough. It certainly wasn't important as an Ingmar Bergman movie, for example. And I felt it was just as important, and in many cases better than many of the Ingmar Bergman movies. Mainstream criticism, if you came up with a film that had a serious subject, the war, or poor people, or the Grapes of Wrath, or something like that, not that there's anything wrong with the Grapes of Wrath, but the Grapes of Wrath isn't any greater than other John Ford films that are not about poor people and their problems.
Film critic Andrew Sarris is my guest. When you started writing about genre films, about Westerns and crime movies, what got you to take them seriously?
Well, I always liked them, and then I decided that was the great genius of the Hollywood system, that it wasn't a realistic art form. It was a mythological art form, and particularly the film noir. I once said, you know, that only a good film teaches you how to live, but even a bad movie can teach you how to die. And the dark films, I thought, particularly in Hollywood, had long been underrated. I think, for example, now, I think some of the most interesting films being made today are in the horror genre. I think a film like The Fly, the new version, is much more interesting than something like Terms of Endearment. It's through sometimes very disreputable genres. And I must confess, it took me a long time to get into the horror genre. I didn't get into that. It was a friend of mine who sort of dragged me screaming into it. But now that I've gotten into it, I find, you know, something like arachnophobia, I find it much more interesting than a lot of so-called humanistic films.
But you've written recently that you think things have swung in the opposite direction, that now genre films are taken so seriously, and yet a lot of the genre films being turned out now are big-budget bores.
Yeah, I think that the problem, even something with sort of an interesting idea like Total Recall, which is based on an interesting idea that sense of consciousness, the trouble with it is it's all bang, bang, bang. It's all one shock after another until finally it's just exhausting. It's just so much, and there's no build-up, and there's no suggestion, there's no development. There's no time even for anything to develop, and it has a terrible ending and all that. What was interesting about, you know, some of the things in the 40s, like the things that Agee discovered and Farber and other critics of that time, the B pictures, the glories of the B pictures, is that they developed very interesting characters and interesting atmosphere and little touches of realism in these, you know, neglected movies that nobody took very seriously. It was the big productions were just sort of completely glossy and phony and empty. And similarly today, I'm not one of those people who say that every movie that costs a lot of money is bad and every movie that, you know, you make in a garage is great. There is something to be said for production values on any level. But there is a tendency now to overproduce, to concentrate. I noticed now particularly one of the things that's changed since all the years that I've never seen credit lists at the end of a movie so long as they are now. They go on for about 10 minutes. I mean, and there are thousands of people. I mean, I wonder how is anybody unemployed in the United States when I see about 300 names after every dinky special effects extravaganza.
You and me must be the only ones staying to watch the names, though.
Everybody's long gone out of
exactly
the theater,
right,
into the street. We're still waiting there. Although we may be listening to the end of the 37th rock tune that they're playing, too. I don't know.
You're really one of the few people I know who has been both a journalist and an academic simultaneously. Do you feel like you've existed in the middle of two worlds?
Yeah, well, that's a line I use in that one article I wrote in Film Comment. I said I've always been too much of a journalist for the academics and too much of an academic for the journalist, so I get caught in between. Yeah, I don't say that film is it supplants anything else. I mean, I think I tell my students very often, some people, you know, they think they can look at a film 25 times and then they'll understand it. I say, no, you don't. You look at it once and then go and read about 10 books and look at 20 paintings and listen to some music and study the world around you and have a life, get a relationship, so on. And then go back to the movie and you'll have some new insights into it. It's not what you get out of movies so much, it's what you put into them. And the justification for my life, for my career, are all the very brilliant people on several continents, London, Paris, New York, and many other cities around the world, who have thought seriously about film and have contributed to film scholarship and have made it a very serious area of study. And so one thing I want to do at Columbia is make film one of the humanities.
My guest is film critic Andrew Sarris. You were very sick for a few years, I believe it was. Can I ask you to describe your condition, what you had?
Yeah, well, my wife has written a book called Molly Haskell, Love and Other Infectious Diseases, and it's about the illness and her reaction to it and how we survived. Well, she had her share of troubles. In the 80s, she had 5 operations. I had 3. And one of mine was very serious. I had something called cytomegalovirus, CMV, which is an opportunistic virus. And a lot of people thought that it was connected with AIDS. I was questioned about it. It wasn't in my case. And it was something of a mystery because it took a long time for anybody to find out. But I was very sick, and I went crazy for a while. And I remember my hallucinations and all that. And it was a harrowing period. And now that it's over, it's interesting to think back on it a little bit. But you know what Nietzsche said: anything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So I guess that was it. But that was it. That was what I had, and I was out for about 7 months, and I came back.
You said that one of the symptoms was going crazy for a while, and your wife in her book says one of the symptoms was paranoia. I was wondering, looking back, how you experienced the paranoia at the time and how you remember it now.
Well, when people, and my wife's mother said that, my mother-in-law said, told people that I'm paranoid. He said, but he was always paranoid. You know, in our field, it's paranoia is more or less. I mean, New York is the home of paranoia. And I was always paranoid. And in fact, I was more paranoid then than I am now. I think the illness sort of got rid of that paranoia, or else I'm not as paranoid about many things as I used to be. Also, people behaved very beautifully. And but I had incredible. I used to think that my mother, that Molly, it's a nice slip there, Freudian slip, that Molly was running around with Frank Sinatra, and Greta Garbo was writing me, and I had all kinds of hallucinations, and that people were trying to kill me, and that Molly was against me, and it was fascinating. In other words, I was. Technically crazy. That is, you know, if I had a gun, I would have killed somebody. And one thing I found about that period, about being crazy, is that it's so boring to be crazy. It's so silly, so stupid. And this is why I'm so very much an Aristotelian. I'm tired of hearing about crazy people. I'm tired of reading about crazy people. I don't find them interesting. I think craziness is... Well, we have certainly too much of it today. It's all over the world. So many people are crazy, and people are doing crazy things. And I think it's a problem, but I think it's a rather boring problem as far as there's nothing to be said about it. That period where I was crazy, it was completely useless. I was useless to anybody. I was a minus to the world.
Did you watch movies when you were sick?
Yeah, I watched them in a very peculiar way. Actually, at times I was so sick, I suddenly realized that I was, when you can get so sick and so tired, so exhausted from illness and pain, that it's too exhausting even to look at television, you realize it takes a certain amount of psychic energy even to look at movies or television. But I used to look at things on television, you know, 'cause I didn't look at movies when I was lying there, but I looked at television, and I used to hallucinate what I was looking at. I used to look at baseball games, and suddenly there would be, you know, characters from Sesame Street, you know, would be stepping up to the plate. You know, it was, you know, there were weird things were happening in my mind.
You came close to death when you were sick.
Yeah, and as some doctor said, I was the sickest person ever to walk out of New York Hospital.
I'm reminded of something you said a little earlier. You said even a bad movie can teach you how to die. I forget what you were, if you were quoting yourself or somebody else, but I was wondering if that's the kind of thing you were thinking about when you were really ill.
No, actually, I decided one thing. I decided that the mind is wonderful in one way. It's, you know, about pain and suffering, the mind, you know, you develop these delusions. I think my craziness helped me survive, because if I had been completely lucid and understood everything that was happening, I think, and knowing how people were terrified about what was happening and how sick I really was, I probably would have died. I would have been so frightened, so depressed, and so forth. But by developing all these hatreds and violence in my mind, it enabled me to fight. I had imaginary enemies to fight, and that kept me going.
Film critic Andrew Sarris is my guest. You and your wife, Molly Haskell, are both film critics.
Yeah.
And I wonder what the rules of the house are about discussing movies before you've written about them. If you're worried about influencing each other's opinions. And you know that sometimes
you'll Well, there was only one brief period in our lives when we had that problem. I was reviewing for The Voice, and Molly was first string critic for New York Magazine. And we were going to the same screenings, and we couldn't talk to each other. And we couldn't use each other's insights. It was very difficult for us because one of the things that got us together, we're a very strange couple in that this respect. We're both doing the same thing. There aren't many married people that are doing exactly the same thing. But Molly comes from a different vantage point. She's become very much a feminist film critic, and she's dealt in that thing. But the problem with us, the reason that we haven't started a Siskel Ebert thing, you know, is that, you know, You know, if I could come on as a male chauvinist pig, you know, and Molly as a, you know, a feminist bitch, you know, and that we'd screech at each other, you know, that would be very good television. But we are disgustingly in agreement. People say, oh, you're in agreement because you're married. And say, no, we got married because we were in agreement, because we do have the same sensibility.
I imagine that a lot of our listeners have video cassette recorders, and video has given us access to film history in a way that we've never really had it before.
That's true.
So let me ask you to name a few of your favorite films, and you could go as far into the past as you want to, films that you might want to recommend to us to see if we haven't already seen them.
Yeah, well, I'd like to recommend, my favorite film of all time is probably Madame Deux, the Max O'Fools film with Daniel Derrière. It's a French film with subtitles. Although I'm on record as saying Lola Montez is the greatest film of all time, but that was some time ago, but I don't agree entirely there, although I still admire it very much. And there's a laser disc where I do a commentary on it. Also, Getsu, the Japanese film, and I don't know, the Mitsuguchi film, and La Règle du Jeu, the Jean Renoir. Those have been, for many years, my three great films. Among American films, films I admire is Orson Welles' Magnificent Ambersons, Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, John Ford's The Searchers, The Great Dictator to Modern Times by Chaplin, Buster Keaton's Steamboat Bill Jr., particularly, Sherlock Jr., and Buñuel's Belle du Jour, Red River, Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West, hundreds. I'm not much on, you know, desert island, you know, if you were going to a desert island, what 10 pictures would you take? I would never go to a desert island, and I would never take just 10 movies. I think I'd just get sick of them. I have to have hundreds of movies and keep seeing new things all the time and changing them. Also, one of the things that I find that I get frustrated sometimes, and people sometimes don't fully appreciate about movies, is that there are so many bad movies.
Yes.
And you have to have some feeling about how bad a movie can be
to appreciate
before you
ones.
Can appreciate why people are so like the good ones.
Well, Andrew Sarris, I thank you very much for talking with us about movies and about your life. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrew Sarris is film critic for the New York Observer and professor of film at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.